So it might be experience the power of his resurrection life, that spiritual life. And he says, if by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead. The resurrection of the dead, okay? Now, when Paul talks about knowing the power of his resurrection, he's talking about walking in measure of spiritual life, resurrection life, in the here and now. But when he says he wants to attain the resurrection from the dead, he's talking about something different. He's talking about a future event, the future event of the physical resurrection of the body. There's two separate ideas in that one sentence, in that one little phrase there he's putting forth, you got to understand it. One idea has to do with walking in spiritual life here and now, spiritual resurrection life, the life of Jesus, here and now through laying down our self-life. As we lay down our self-life, Christ's life comes forth. That's resurrection life, that's spiritual life. As we die daily, as we allow God to put us through suffering, the spiritual resurrection life of Jesus comes forth. The other idea has to do with attaining the resurrection of the dead. The resurrection of the dead. That's a whole different issue. That's a reference to the future event, which has to do with the resurrection of the physical body. Now, Paul's saying here, or it seems like he's saying very clearly, that he's trying to attain the resurrection from the dead. I don't know if anybody sees that. That's what he's saying. He's trying to attain the resurrection from the dead. Now, if he's trying to attain the resurrection from the dead, that means, it seems to mean, he's viewing physical resurrection as a reward, which can be gained or lost. Else he wouldn't be trying to attain it. It sure seems as if he's trying to attain a bodily resurrection, like a reward, that kind of thing. But the idea that the resurrection of the body is a reward, which can be gained or lost, that's never bore witness with me, because what the scripture says all the place, which is that everyone, the wicked, the righteous, everyone, they're all going to be raised from the dead at some point. Okay, so I began looking into this. What does he mean here? Why would he be striving to attain a bodily resurrection? It doesn't make any sense. Let me see. We'll just give you these two verses about the resurrection, just so you know. Daniel 12, 1 through 2 says, at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in a book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. That's the resurrection. Some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Jesus said in John chapter 5, he says, marvel not at this, for the hour is coming, in the which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice, and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. So both Daniel and Jesus state very clearly that everyone who has ever lived physically will be resurrected physically at some point. The righteous will come forth unto a resurrection of life. The wicked will come forth unto a resurrection of damnation. Nobody has to attain a physical resurrection, is my point. A physical resurrection is automatic. All you got to do is get resurrected physically, is die physically. That's all you got to do. There's nothing to attain there. Yet it seems very clear that Paul was trying to attain the resurrection of the body. That's what he's saying. And that was a contradiction in my mind. So the seeming contradiction is cleared up when you look at the original Greek of that verse. And this is one of those times when the Greek sheds important light, additional light on the English translation, because the term that's translated resurrection there in that passage, it's a very unusual Greek term. If you look at the Greek definition of this term in any Greek dictionary, like Vines, Expository Dictionary or something, you'll find that nearly every reference to the resurrection, the bodily resurrection, in the New Testament is the Greek word anastasis. And anastasis means a standing up or a raising up. That means a raising up from death or a standing up from physical death. But the term Paul uses here in Philippians is ex anastasis. It's the same Greek word, except he adds a prefix ek, which means from or out of. So the meaning of that Greek term there is different than the standard term for resurrection. It actually means the out resurrection from the dead. The out resurrection from the dead. The little translation of what Paul said there in that line is, if somehow I should be attaining to the resurrection that is out from among the dead. So that's how it goes in original Greek. If somehow I should be attaining to the resurrection that is out from among the dead. This is the only place in the entire New Testament, the entire Bible, that term, ex anastasis, is used. So to me, that means it's very insignificant. Paul had a reason for using that particular term instead of the one that's always used to describe the idea of general physical resurrection. He deliberately chose to use a term that means a resurrection out from among the dead, or a resurrection out from among the general resurrection of the dead. You see? Because Paul, I believe, was not seeking to be conformed to Christ's death in order to just apprehend a regular general physical resurrection. He was doing that to apprehend a special physical resurrection. A special physical resurrection called the out-resurrection, okay? I don't think anybody could argue that. But the question is, what is this out-resurrection? Okay, that's the question. What is this out-resurrection? What is this different thing that Paul's talking about here? And I believe the out-resurrection is the first resurrection. It's the resurrection that is out from among the general resurrection. It's the resurrection that is ahead of the general resurrection. See, the general resurrection is the second resurrection. It's not the first resurrection. So in my view, while everyone will automatically experience a physical resurrection of some kind, not everyone will automatically attain the out-resurrection, because that's a reward. That resurrection is a reward. And it's not attained through physical death. It's attained through Adamic death. It's attained through death to self. That's what Paul is saying. You know, I'm dying. I'm seeking to be conformed to this death, if by any means I may attain that resurrection. Qualifying for the first resurrection has nothing to do with being saved or lost. The resurrection that will determine the eternal fate of all mankind, except those who come forth with the first resurrection, is the second resurrection, which takes place at the end of the millennium. And at that resurrection, I believe both Christians and non-Christians will come forth and be rewarded as God sees fit. Well, the out-resurrection, I believe, has to do with the bringing together of God's first fruits from all generations, the royal priesthood, in order to reign with Jesus for 1,000 years. I want to show you what Rotherham's Emphasized Bible says, how that translates, because it's very interesting. I found this Bible long after I feel God showed me this, but it's interesting because it really, for me, it cinched it. Rotherham's Emphasized Bible version, that verse goes like this. To get to know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed unto his death, if by any means I may advance to the earlier resurrection, which is from among the dead, not that I have already received or have already reached perfection, but I am pressing on, if I may even lay hold of that for which I have also been laid hold of by Jesus Christ. I don't believe all Christians are going to come forth at the earlier resurrection, which is the first resurrection. Only those who have paid the necessary price will come forth at that resurrection. That's what I believe. The rest are going to come forth at the general resurrection, which is the second resurrection, where they're going to have to be judged because they didn't allow God to fully judge them while alive in the flesh. And I realize this concept is totally foreign to everybody and probably even heretical. You know, that's all right. I'm just sharing what I feel God showed me. In order to understand this, I want to look at the first resurrection and second resurrection a little bit tonight. The first resurrection is the resurrection that happens when the last trumpet sounds, the seventh trumpet, and the Lord descends from heaven. This resurrection is described in Revelation 20, 1 through 6. This is what it says. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be loosed a little season. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, which had not worshipped the beast in his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived, that means they're raised from the dead, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead lived not again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such a second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. I just want to call your attention to the fact that what's said about the people who are at this resurrection. John says they're going to be priests of God and they're going to reign with Jesus 1,000 years. But as I've tried to show previously here, I believe there's at least three requirements in the New Testament that a believer must meet before he can reign with Christ. Clearly laid out there, he must be an overcomer, he must keep the works of Christ until the end, and he must suffer with Christ. So you have a choice as to how you're going to view what's happening here at the first resurrection. You can hold to the traditional view that says all Christians are going to be raised at this resurrection. You know, or you can believe that only the ones who have met the requirements that are laid out in the New Testament are going to be raised at that resurrection. You know, if the passages that I've looked at so far say what they seem to say, which is that there are certain requirements that must be met before we can reign with Christ, and if all who have part in the first resurrection are going to reign with Christ, then in my simple understanding, what that means is only the ones who have met the requirements going to come forth at the first resurrection. Can you see that, where I'm coming from? If there's certain requirements to rule and reign going to have to be met, and if it says those who come forth at the first resurrection are going to rule and reign, then I believe those people met those requirements. You know, in short, I believe it's a reward. Like entering a marriage, having the first resurrection, being ruling with Jesus, that's a reward. for the faithful. It's not a part of the package deal. Now, before you draw up a list of objections and questions, let me share something with you that may help you understand where I'm coming from a little bit. The next age, which will be the kingdom age, of course, right? The next age is not the climax of God's program for the human race. It's not even the climax of God's program for the wife he's bringing forth for his son. The climax of God's plan for both mankind in general and the church in particular does not come until after the kingdom age, when the new Jerusalem comes down to dwell on a new earth among the saved nations. The kingdom age, the next age, the millennium, the messianic kingdom, it's a distinct period of only 1,000 years. That's half the length of the church age. It's not the new heaven and new earth age, which is going to last forever. What it is, it's the third division of the 7,000-year program God has designed for this present earth. I'll say it again. The millennial kingdom, the last 1,000 years, is the third division of the 7,000-year program God designed for this present earth. You had 4,000 years for the Old Testament. You got 2,000 years for the New Testament. You got 1,000 years for the kingdom of the millennium. That's all God's program for this present earth. Then after that comes the new heaven and the new earth. And there are several reasons why God designed his plan so that we don't go straight from this present age and this present earth into the eternal age and the new earth. There's a reason he has the millennium stuck in the middle there. All right? A couple reasons, actually, but I'm just going to share one. The main reason. The main reason is because ruling over the nations of this planet for 1,000 years, that's part of Messiah's reward for overcoming while walking in the flesh. See, we're talking about our reward here, but see, Messiah has a reward too. And he's got much of his reward in heaven already. Part of his reward is going to be the bride when the wife is married. But there's another part of his reward, and that's ruling over the nations. That's promised to him. It was promised to him in the Psalms. It was promised to him all in the Old Testament. He won that reward by coming to earth, living as a man, and overcoming. So what I'm saying is, him ruling in the next stage, it's his kingdom, and that's his reward for overcoming. He's going to receive an earthly kingdom. He's going to sit on David's throne. He's going to rule over the nations of this present earth with a rod of iron for the time allotted by the Father, which is 1,000 years. And those who overcome as he overcame, they're going to partake of that same reward with him. They're going to rule the nations with a rod of iron. Now, after that 1,000-year period, Messiah's rule over the nation on this present earth, it's going to end. Then comes a great white throne judgment. Then we all go into the final eternal age, the final kingdom, the new heaven and new earth, which is going to be established by God. There's a transition going to happen, okay? And Paul speaks of the transition from Messiah's kingdom to the eternal kingdom in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. It's very interesting. After discussing the different aspects of the resurrection of the body, you know, he says we're all going to come forth with different bodies. Some are going to shine like the stars and different glory and all that. He says this in 1 Corinthians 15, 24 to 28. He says, then cometh the end, when he, that is the Son, shall have delivered up the kingdom, that's the millennial kingdom, to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. For he, that is the Son, must reign till, see, he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last thing which shall be destroyed is death. For he, the Father, hath put all things under his, the Son's, feet. But when he, the Father, saith all things are put under him, is manifest that he, that is the Father, is accepted, which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, that's the Son, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. So when you read that passage here, you get this picture. Jesus is going to reign over an earthly kingdom as God's Messiah on his present earth until a certain point. And when is that certain point? That point is when the last enemy, which is death, is finally destroyed. And when does the Bible say death is finally destroyed? It says death is destroyed after the great white throne judgment. Revelation 20, 13, 14 says, and the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works, and death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. Okay, that's the second death. So according to what Paul's saying there, in some way that I can't fully understand or explain, there will be a certain period of time in which the Father exalts the Son to such a degree that the Son will not be completely under or subject to the Father. Then at some point later, the Son is going to voluntarily place himself back under the complete subjection of the Father. Like I said, I don't quite know all this, what it means, but some of it I do. I believe it has to do with the Messianic kingdom and the absolute dominion Jesus, the Messiah, is going to rule over that kingdom, okay? The Messianic kingdom will be particularly and peculiarly the Son's kingdom. It's going to be the Son's kingdom. And during that time, death is still going to be operating. And Paul says that When this particular aspect of God's program has been completed, that is, when the 1,000 years expires, then the Son also himself will be subject unto him that put all things under him, which is the Father. So at that point, the great white throne judgment takes place, and then we all move into the next age, which is the eternal age of the new heaven and the new earth. So in other words, the age that will be particularly and peculiarly Messiah's age is going to come to an end. Okay, the next age is particularly Messiah's age. It's his kingdom. It's his reward. It's going to come to an end, and we're all going to go into the next age, which will not be particularly and peculiarly Messiah's age. Okay, at that point, the Son will be completely subject to the Father again. The new world age will be the kingdom of the entire Trinity, not just the kingdom of Messiah specifically. I don't know if you get my point there. My point in sharing that is just to expand your vision a little bit of what the coming kingdom, the millennial kingdom, is all about. I'm not trying to deny the rest of the church the joy of being raised physically and being with the Lord. Every true believer is going to experience these things. It's just a matter of timing. Those who miss the first resurrection are only going to miss the reward of entering into the marriage and of ruling and reigning over the nations for 1,000 years. Those who don't qualify, they're still going to be raised physically at the second resurrection. They're going to be given glorified bodies based on the works, and they're going to go into the eternal age along with the ones who have attained the first resurrection. So the separation that takes place at the first resurrection will be undone, and we'll all be joined together in the New Jerusalem and going to the next age. It's a short separation of the overcomer from the non-overcomer. From the Zion and Jerusalem, there's a short separation. It's 1,000 years. And some of the Christians who are more faithful are going to partake of a few rewards that other Christians aren't. But in the end, we're all brought back together in the New Jerusalem. We all go into the new age, the new world, and new heaven and earth together as one church. Now, in a minute, I'm going to address the four main reasons why people reject the view I've shared with you tonight about the first resurrection. And hopefully that's going to answer most of the questions you might have. But first, you might be thinking, well, if what this guy is saying is true, you know, how's God going to work it so that only the ones who qualify to rule and reign with Jesus are around when Jesus returns? I mean, this is an easy thing for the people who are dead, right? God just leaves them in the ground. But what about the ones who are still alive? What are we going to do with the people who are alive that aren't overcomers? Are they going to go into their marriage? Or are they going to go into the kingdom and be ruled over, or what? See, that's where I have a problem. So my view is the only ones who are going to be alive when the Lord returns are the ones who will be qualified to rule with him. It's pretty simple in my mind, but maybe it's not in yours. See, I'm not sure most of us realize just what's coming down the pike. I'm not sure people realize what kind of hours of this age, that if God doesn't intervene, every single person on this planet will perish. Every single person on this planet is going to perish on this planet if God doesn't stop what's happening, what's going to come down. The last 3.5 years, especially the last few months. Jesus said twice, in different places, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. That's not talking about no flesh be saved and go into the kingdom, salvation. It's talking about no flesh be alive. Every bit of flesh will be destroyed, okay? But for the next sake, those days will be shortened. Except God shortens what's about to come down the pike, what's about to hit the fan here, no flesh will be saved. Every living creature on this planet would perish. That's how bad it's going to get. It's going to get pretty bad, my friends. I mean, really bad. Especially for Christians, you see. The combination of all nations hating Christians, plus us not being able to buy or sell without taking the mark of the beast, plus the almost total destruction of the planet that's coming, all these things will put us in a position where the only Christians are going to survive will be the ones who are kept alive supernaturally by God. I don't believe there's any kind of preparation. You can't go in the woods and stockpile food and stockpile guns and get yourself generators to get off the electrical grid. I'm telling you, it's going to get so bad. The only thing that's going to save the Christian, what's coming, is God's supernatural power. Okay, and under those circumstances, I think it's going to be pretty easy for God to weed out, so to speak, the ones who aren't fit to rule. The ones that aren't fit to rule in the grave will stay in the grave. The ones that aren't fit to rule that are alive, they'll end up dying. You see, when the reality of what's coming on this planet finally sinks in, Paul's words to the believers in Thessalonica about being caught up in the air to meet the Lord, you know, when he comes, they take on a little different light, a little weightier matter. In 4:17 and 18, he says this, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them, okay? We which are alive and remain. It's going to be no small matter to be alive and remaining when the Lord comes, okay? And those who do, I believe, will be fit to rule when Jesus returns. Now, I'm going to answer four basic objections I've come across regarding the view I've presented here, that not all Christians are going to come forth the first resurrection. There's certain requirements to rule the nations, all that. Just going to give you four basic objections. I'm sure there's more out there, and I'm sure somebody in the room could come up with more. But these are the four that I run into the most. So before you all type in your questions and throw scriptures at me, let me go through this, and then if there's anything left that I haven't covered, go ahead. One is the passages which seem to indicate that every Christian will be raised at the Lord's return. That's one objection. Another objection is the ones not at the first resurrection, it says can or will, well, it depends how you translate it, can be hurt by the second death. The next objection is it seems like everyone at the second resurrection is eternally lost. And the last one is, what about the Old Testament saints? They couldn't possibly meet the New Testament requirements. So the first objection regards the passage that seems to indicate that every Christian will be at the first resurrection, all those passages in the New Testament. And I want to look at one of them quick before I go on. The one in Colossians 3, 1 through 4. This is what Paul says. He says, if you be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, not on things on earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. I'd like you to notice that Paul didn't just say, when Christ appears, we shall all appear with him in glory. He said, when Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall we appear with him in glory. Christ is a revelation that nobody seems to ever take notice of. And I can tell you that for the majority of those who are truly born again now, Christ is still not their life. He's added to their life. There's a big difference. Now, as for all the other scriptures that you come up with, is there anything I can say? Not every mention of the resurrection in the Bible is going to contain the whole picture that's presented on the subject. Individual passages that speak about the resurrection, they have to be determined by the overall teaching on the subject. Let me give you an example here. From what we just read, the two passages we looked at, Daniel and Jesus referring to resurrection, you probably didn't notice this, but if you look at those passages again, I'll give you the references again. It's Daniel 12, 2 and John 5, 28. If you look at those passages, you'll notice that both Daniel and Jesus ignore, totally ignore, the fact that there's two separate resurrections. Okay, this is what Daniel said. Daniel said, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And Jesus says, the hour is coming in which that all that are in the grave shall hear his voice and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. Okay? So they're talking about as if the resurrection is one event, and in that one event, both the wicked and the righteous are going to come forth and be judged. Okay? I mean, even according to the traditional view, the righteous and the wicked are not raised together. The righteous and the wicked are raised at two different resurrections. They're separated by 1,000 years. The righteous are raised the first resurrection, then there's 1,000 years, then the wicked are raised. That's the traditional view. So why would Daniel and Jesus talk as if both the righteous and the wicked are raised at the same time? I mean, maybe Daniel didn't know what was going on. Maybe Daniel was in the Old Testament, maybe he didn't know. But do you think Jesus didn't know that the righteous and the wicked wouldn't be raised at the same time? I don't think that. For me, a more plausible answer is that Jesus was simply trying to make a point. The point being that we're all going to be raised from the dead at some point and be judged according to what we've done in this life. He wasn't necessarily trying to explain all the details about the two different resurrections, since he ignored a major truth there concerning them. All right? In 2 Peter 3, I think 9 through 14, he talks about the day of the Lord. He says this, the Lord is not slack concerning the promises, as some men count slackness, but long-suffering to usward, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come, as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away, and the great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also, and the works therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that these things shall be dissolved, what men or persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Looking for and hastening unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens, being on fire, shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we look according to this promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that you look for these things, be diligent that you be found in him of peace, without spot, and blameless. Okay?